In 1938, that became the musical signature that preceded all 20th century Fox movies. In the classic era of Hollywood films, the signature of each studio extended far beyond the opening logo. My guest Thomas Schatz has written a new book about the distinctive movie-making styles of the studios, focusing on MGM, Warner Brothers, and Universal. He looks at the 1920s to the 1950s, when the studios wielded nearly absolute power over the film industry. They produced and distributed movies and even ran their own theater chains. Each studio had its own repertoire of contract stars, story formulas, production techniques, and marketing styles. And each was ruled by strong-willed and opinionated executives who Schatz describes as the most misunderstood and undervalued figures in American film history. Thomas Schatz is the director of graduate studies in radio, TV, and film at the University of Texas in Austin. He also writes for several film magazines and lectures at the American Film Institute. His new book is titled The Genius of the System. I asked Schatz why he's studying the days of the Hollywood studio system.
Well, it has something to do, I suppose, with my impression of the contemporary film industry, which is in, it strikes me, utter disarray, and also with the persistent appeal of those old movies. Obviously, it's beyond just the fact that I write and teach about film. It's trying to make sense out of how that system worked and how it was in fact a system. And the more closely I look at it, the more I come to understand that this really delicate balance kind of business and artistic interests really worked the way that system was structured. And it's also a matter, I suppose, of trying to make sense out of whether or not, when I first got interested in studying film and writing about film, film criticism was really dominated by what folks call the auteur theory, which is the notion that the director is the author of the film. And the more I learned about Hollywood, particularly the old Hollywood studio system, the less sense that made to me. And I really was interested in trying to really dig into that, into the records, et cetera, of that era, and try to make sense out of how it did work and how important not only the director was, but the star, the screenwriter, the composer, the producer, the studio executive, and so on.
Describe what a studio is. A studio is really a whole self-contained world.
That's right. Anywhere from a couple of hundred to a couple of thousand employees, literally a physically self-contained environment with not only all those sound stages, anywhere from a half a dozen to, say, 20 sound stages, but also a back lot for shooting exteriors. And, construction, literally barbershops, everything from barbershops and milliners to, large plants where sets are constructed. These were environments where a virtual world could be created, in the span of a couple of months. And if we stop for a minute and think about what's involved in that, and the fact that anywhere from 6 to 10 films were in production at the same time on these various sound stages, that literally these narrative universes were being created and taken apart, week in and week out.
You suggest that each of the Hollywood studios had their own house style.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that important? Why does that matter that they each had their own style?
Well, for one thing, it was a matter of distinguishing their product from their competitors. And whether we're aware of it or not, I think when we're watching, an old Jimmy Cagney gangster film, we know at some level that we're watching a Warner Brothers film. Or when we're watching, an Andy Hardy movie, we know it's an MGM film. And we're watching an old horror film with Boris Karloff, that we're watching a Universal picture. At some level, that's registering, and at some level, I think we're very much aware of the fact that certain companies turned out a certain product. It's also worth keeping in mind that in the old days, they had regulated patterns of distribution and exhibition. That you knew that if you went to a certain theater, in the old days, the Orpheum or the Paramount or the State Theater, that you were going to see a film with certain stars, probably with certain genres that were cranked out by a certain company.
If Warner Brothers was more associated with gangster films and Busby Berkeley musicals,
mm-hmm.
and MGM with a certain kind of screwball comedy, and later with Fred Astaire musicals, and Universal with horror movies like The Mummy and Frankenstein, Dracula,
mm-hmm.
did these styles come out of marketing decisions or out of the sensibilities of the people who work there? Was it a combination of the two?
Definitely a combination of a combination of the personalities, quite literally, primarily I think of the studio studio executives as much as the top talent, and also without question, pretty basic marketing decisions. Universal, you know, with its European distribution system, a heavy emphasis on Germany, knew that its horror films would play well in Germany. Warner Brothers was a company that owned very few what they would then have called prestige or first run theaters. And it knew its pictures. It was more of a working class studio, and it knew it. It knew that its clientele was what we would now say more blue collar. MGM and Paramount owned a large number of first class, first run, deluxe downtown theaters, and they turned out sophisticated comedies. They turned out much more sophisticated product, and that was very much as you know a marketing decision, you know, as well as a matter of and you know those marketing decisions were what were behind developing certain types of personnel at the studios.
Right, because I guess if you're doing gangster movies, then if you had a kind of cast of characters on salary who were good for those movies, you had it made.
Exactly, that's exactly right. And it's also worth pointing out that you know that MGM was not only into sophisticated comedy, but it was into you know love stories. I mean, it was a very wealthy studio that was into putting two or three stars. And the maybe best example from the 30s is Grand Hotel, which was one of the granddaddies of the all-star pictures, they used to call them. Whereas Warner Brothers very rarely put more than one of its stars in any picture. And we tend to associate individual stars with genres as a result. Betty Davis melodramas, Errol Flynn swashbucklers, Jimmy Cagney crime films, you know, Paul Muni biopics. That they didn't put their stars together because it was not efficient. And this was not a company that had the kind of money that MGM did in those days.
My guest is Thomas Schatz, and we're talking about the subject of his new book, The Genius of the System, which is about Hollywood filmmaking in the studio era. The balance of power within the Hollywood studios was really different than the balance of power in filmmaking today.
That's for sure.
First of all, there was the star system, mm-hmm. and the actors were really controlled by the studios. They were cast by the studios. They were groomed by the studios. And as you pointed out, there was a lot of typecasting, and therefore there was very little creative freedom for the actors. Now, Betty Davis is someone you describe as having gotten around the system.
Right.
What was the problem she was having, and how did she get around it?
Well, Betty Davis worked at Warner Brothers, which in the 1930s was very much dominated by male stars, Jimmy Cagney, Edward G. Robinson, Paul Muni, etc., and male-oriented story formulas, gangster pictures, and so on, biopics, swashbucklers. And Betty Davis was being cast time and again in crime films. She did make an occasional melodrama, but there was a woman named Kay Francis who was at the studio that got most of those parts. And Davis really felt that there was more that she could do, and she wasn't getting the opportunity to do it. Things got interesting when the only loan out of Davis's career during the 1930s, and we're talking about literally dozens and dozens of films, was to RKO in 1934 to do a film called Of Human Bondage. And it was really the first time that what we would think of, she played the Cockney prostitute, this kind of emasculating bitch. And the kind of role that we tend to associate with Betty Davis, this was the first chance she really had to display that personality. And it was a huge hit, and it got Warner's thinking a little bit differently about what she might be able to do, but not differently enough. She wound up doing a film called Dangerous, which won an Academy Award and literally went on strike, did not work for a year, and went to Europe and wound up in court with Jack Warner.
She was refusing to make movies that she didn't want to
make.
Yeah,
which in those days was tough because the way the contract system worked, if you were suspended, she just basically took a suspension. You couldn't sit out your contract. She had a 7-year contract. And while you were suspended, they would just tack that time on to the duration of the contract. So basically she knew that it wasn't a matter of just sitting out the contract but waiting out Jack Warner, knowing that she'd never get out of that contract. And eventually Jack Warner, after a long court battle, which Warner's won, to try to keep her, basically to keep her from working for another company, Jack Warner did finally buy the rights to Jezebel, which she'd been bugging him for 2 years to do since he wouldn't let her play Scarlett O'Hara. He'd made that real clear. He wouldn't let her to David Selznick for Gone with the Wind. But he did buy Jezebel, which allowed her to play this Southern aristocratic bitch. And it was a fabulous role, won an Academy Award, and really did set her off into that string of fabulous movies of the next couple of years, Dark Victory, now Voyager, The Letter, etc. Great movies.
Katharine Hepburn was another actress who was having a problem within the studio system.
You bet. Katharine Hepburn did kind of the same thing. She won a couple of Academy Awards very early. She was had a couple of nominations and actually did win one early. In 1938, she was basically was voted by the major exhibitors of the United States as being box office poison. There was a list they had every year of stars who they thought were overrated and could not pull their weight at the box office. And the studio let her know that they were not going to be giving her the same kind of important roles. This was RKO, and she bolted. She basically went back to New York, said, "I'm not going to work in pictures anymore." She went back and did a Philip Berry play, Philadelphia Story, and in lieu of a salary, she took the screen rights. She basically had Berry give her the screen rights to the play, and when the play was a hit, she went back to Hollywood, went to Louis B. Mayer at MGM, and basically packaged the project. Said, I want, I'll give you the screen rights for $250,000. I want George Cukor to direct. I want Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart to co-star. And that film, of course, was a huge hit, and it really did initiate a long tenure of Hepburn's at MGM. And she, and it was Hepburn, as a matter of fact, who, as a follow-up to that, suggested that they do Woman of the Year with Tracy. She'd never met Tracy before. She was the one that basically told Mayer that if she was going to do another film, she wanted to co-star with Tracy. And she, without question, had more power than anyone at that studio during the 1940s. And basically, it was a matter of her leaving Hollywood and coming back on her own terms. And it's important to note in both Davis and Hepburn's case that the system wasn't totally inflexible. And these stories aren't that isolated. You know, we could look at the careers of people like Bogart. There are a number of other people who really went through a period of not having much control over their career and eventually got it.
Yeah, but for the most part, the actors were owned and groomed and controlled.
Right, that's
by
right.
The studio. Now, in looking at how the roles of different people who make movies have changed over the years, you say that the production executives have been the most misunderstood and undervalued figures in film history.
Right.
And you're referring, again, back to the days of the Hollywood studio system. How did the role of producer compare? I mean, what did a producer do then that's different from what a producer does now?
Well, one real important distinction is that there was a hierarchy of authority at these studios. There was literally a higher echelon of people with a lot of power that went from the studio boss to the production chief to producers who produced individual films. And if anyone really controlled the process of production, it was the production chief. It was Thalberg at MGM. It was Zanuck when he was at Warner Brothers. These were individuals who basically coordinated the entire production process, but they also assigned individual producers to supervise the films, who were basically their assistants. And these were the guys who took a film from conception literally through release, and who were involved in budgeting the entire year's schedule. And, you know, we tend to, and we shouldn't undervalue the director. The director is extremely important, but a film would go through lengthy pre-production supervised by the production executive, the production chief, before the director had any involvement at all, and it would go through elaborate post-production editing, retakes, previews, and basically we have an individual at these studios who kept track of the entire program of pictures, who took individual pictures from conception all the way through release, and who really did in effect orchestrate the entire process. It was a real efficient way to make movies. These days, you know, we're in a situation where the director has gotten a lot more authority. Most directors are really what we would call hyphenates. They're producer directors. They play the role that a supervisor in the old system would have played in terms of taking a project from conception through release. But there isn't the support structure of a studio anymore. There isn't the kind of productivity and the kind of contract personnel, both above and below the line, as they say in the business. You know, a lot of cinematographers and set designers, as well as actors and writers. There isn't the same kind of structure and it was really, you know, the efficiency of the people that orchestrated that structure that made the old system work as effectively as it did, I think.
Well, one thing the producer didn't have to do during the studio system is raise money, which is something that the producer spends a lot of time
That's right.
Well, doing
that's,
now.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. And we're looking at a period when, as they say in the business world, that the industry was vertically integrated, which meant that the most powerful studios, MGM, Warner Brothers, Paramount, etc., not only made movies, but they had their own distribution and exhibition chains. When I was a kid, for example, a young kid, was the studio system was just coming unraveled, I went to the State Theater, and that would have been a Lowe's MGM. I went to the Orpheum Theater, that would have been RKO. I went to the Paramount, which of course was a Paramount studio-owned theater. The point here being that these were mainly what we would call palaces, those huge theaters. We can't even conceive of it these years, where a good-sized theater is now 500 seats. These were theaters that had 1,000 to 5,000 seats in them, 80-foot screens. They cranked out an enormous amount of revenue, and they created the kind of cash flow that enabled these studios to keep cooking and to crank out a feature film a week, which is far, far beyond what any studio can turn out these years.
You were just telling us about how the studios also owned the theaters mm-hmm. that they screened the movies at, and that was challenged in, I think it was, the late 1940s. Was it who actually accuse them of having a monopoly or an oligopoly, whichever it was.
Actually, the challenge initially came in the late 1930s. Without getting into a whole lot of detail, Roosevelt came in, National Recovery Administration, all that business. They basically gave a number of industries in the United States, including the film industry, not quite carte blanche, but they allowed industries to develop overtly monopolistic practices simply to survive the Depression. And so basically the integrated system of production, distribution, exhibition was okayed by the government, and it was allowed up to a point. As the economy began to recover in the late 1930s, the government began to kind of reconsider these monopoly practices. But what happened in the movie industry was theater owners that wanted to develop big theaters in the cities realized that those markets were controlled and really tied up by the major studios. So it was the theater owners that initially encouraged the Justice Department to go after the integrated majors, and this is a court case that was what we now call the Paramount Decree, because Paramount was the first studio named in the suit. It was adjudicated finally in May 1948, but actually was initiated in late 1938. It took them 10 years to work it out, and basically the studios were able to fend off the government for 10 years, and the outcome of that suit basically was that the studios would have to siphon off their theater holdings. And every movie would have to be, produced on a unit by unit basis and sold that way. And every theater out there in the world would have to have an equal shot at any film that was produced.
Was that responsible for the collapse of the studio system?
It was sure a key issue. I mean, there are so many things that happened.
What else happened?
Well, this gets very complicated. The rise of the unions and the guilds gave individuals more power, and individuals, particularly what we call in the industry above the line individuals, and these are the top talent, writers, directors, producers, stars, composers. It gave them more talent individually. It gave them more leverage than the system, and it made the production process more complicated, because they did have the ability to, I mean, you got five or six people telling you how a film has to be made if they're going to work on it. It creates problems. What also happened, and this is a complicated deal, but it's extremely important, and is the changing tax laws that basically to finance the defense buildup in World War II, and this is worth going into, it's a remarkable statistic, the 80% tax bracket dropped from $5 million annual income to $200,000. So that basically people who were making $200,000 were taking home only a very small fraction, 10 to 20% of their income, if it was a salary. And capital gains tax, if you started a company, an independent company of your own, and risked your income as literally as a venture, you could be taxed at only 25%. So you had a lot of top talent, not just stars, but also directors and producers, looking to start their own independent companies. This is before the Paramount Decree. So one of the things that's happening is individual power is becoming more and more of an issue. Now, what also happens, obviously, after World War II, is that, two important things are television.
Mm-hmm.
Network television comes along. And commercial TV emerges literally from 45 to 48, and it clearly is threatening to displace the movies. I mean, people now watch TV the way we used to go to the movies as a kind of primary means of narrative screen entertainment. And what's also happening after the war is massive changes in American lifestyles, the baby boom, suburbanization, families literally in an unprecedented, unbelievable numbers are being not only generated, but they're being generated away from the inner cities, away from the urban centers where the biggest theaters were. And if we just think about what was going on in the late 40s, early 50s, perhaps in our own lives and our parents' lives, what that's doing is it's moving, the primary market away from the theaters. And this is the birth of the drive-in. I mean, all kinds of things in the ultimately suburban theaters, multiplex theaters, and shopping malls. We're seeing a this, along with the Paramount Decree, is really literally disintegrating the old system.
Well, the studios basically became financing and distribution companies,
right,
after the collapse of the studio system. What do you think we lost when the studios collapsed?
Okay, we lost. Actually, it's worth pointing out that the very folks that screamed loudest about the old system, the theater owners, are the ones that suffered the most. Because what happened was, when the studios no longer had an integrated system, they lost their cash flow, and they lost when they no longer had their own system of distribution, exhibition. They didn't have those revenues constantly coming in from the theaters to pay overhead at the studio. So what happened initially was all those contract personnel were fired. And in a span of, from 48 to 55, the old studio system, literally, I mean, in terms of all those contract personnel, those literally hundreds to thousands of people that worked for each of the studios were let go, and the whole nature of employment in the film business changed. And that, obviously, we lost the kind of continuity and efficiency of that old system. And the theater owners, we were no longer cranking out movies at the same rate, and the theater owners didn't have product. Not only that, but there was a tendency to bet more on individual films. Every film became an independent business venture. And we see the beginning of what we now call the blockbuster syndrome, mm-hmm. Which is bet the ranch on individual films. And, in the old days when 80% of the films released made money, that was no longer possible, literally. And now it was a matter of, you just hope every fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth movie release does excellent business and makes up, for the losses on your other pictures. So that kind of mentality, that kind of winner-take-all blockbuster mentality has become more and more prevalent. I also think we lost the kind of continuity that came from, when we think of the old studio system, we do tend to think of these star genre formulations. We tend to think of a star and associate him or her with a whole series of pictures. And what made that work was not just the studio system, but it was these production units that emerged at every studio. The fact that the same personnel worked on one Bette Davis melodrama after another, or worked on one Humphrey Bogart crime thriller after another, or worked on whatever it would be, and that the Freed unit at MGM cranking out all those musicals, those great Gene Kelly, Judy Garland musicals, that the stability of the studios in general allowed those units to flourish, and they allowed these collaborative groups to work together. And I don't think there's much question, but that the consistency in terms of quality was something that we've never seen anything remotely similar to since.
Well, you could say that Francis Coppola's Zoetrope Studio and George Lucas's Lucasfilms were attempts to recreate a smaller version of the studio
right.
system. What did they show? What do you think of the results looking back now?
Yeah, and I don't think the impulse will ever go away to recreate the studio system. But without that kind of overarching integration that held the business at large together, it's not going to work. What also is a real problem, and we should think of Robert Altman, the guy that made MASH and a lot of really great movies, but he started a thing called Lionsgate, that there were a number of efforts in the 70s and 80s to recreate the studio system. Part of the problem was, particularly with Coppola and Altman, is that these guys were not businessmen. They were not producers. And the people that have really succeeded, and Lucas is the best example, the people that have really succeeded in recreating at least a sense of a studio environment are individuals who really are at heart producers, not directors, not writers, and they literally don't think of themselves as artists the same way that, without question, Coppola has thought of himself over the years. And that, but again, without this kind of regulated output, and without a marketplace that's more stable, there's no way you can dependably crank out a lot of pictures with the hope of selling them and of them doing well. The closest thing right now actually is at Walt Disney. A guy named Michael Eisner is running that studio, and he too is trying to get back to, and I think they may be pulling it off more effectively than anyone has in the last 40 years, really getting back to a kind of regulated output. They're up to, they claim, 25 to 30 pictures a year now, and I think they can do it. And the pictures are doing quite well, and it's a matter largely, I think, of Eisner understanding, how to put a certain amount of continuity and efficiency into that system.
Do you think that there are any strengths of working without studios now? One I could maybe think of is that it's possible for small films, small personal films that don't belong to any studio to get made. And I'm thinking, I guess, of some of the films. And I don't know if you'd consider this to be like a studio, that are funded by Channel 4, like
sure.
A Beautiful Laundrette, Mona Lisa.
Right.
Pretty cheap films that are very interesting, very idiosyncratic.
Right. And that is something that the studio system could not have produced. On the one hand, the studio system was responsible for some real interesting innovation and experimentation, but there were certain limits that were put on creativity and inventiveness in that old era. And there wasn't room for personal filmmaking. You even with a film like Citizen Kane or say a John Ford Western or something, there's no way that an individual in that old system could have the kind of creative control over the entire product, the production of an individual film, the way that an individual can now. And so you get more quirky films now, you get more personal films, you get more idiosyncratic product. The scale's a little bit nuts, though. I mean, the opportunities for individual filmmakers to break in, or the opportunity of a film that's made for only, quote unquote, say $1 to $5 million, actually doing any business is pretty remote, unless you've got someone like Channel 4 behind you, unless you've got an outlet for product guaranteed on the way in.
One last question. When you're looking at a classic Hollywood film now, with your awareness of the studio system, does it affect how you see that movie, what you look for in that movie, what you think about when you watch it?
Well, no. I really think a good movie, I'd like to think at least, that even with the occupational hazard of you know, writing about and teaching about films and all that business, you know, a good movie still captures my imagination, and I'd like to think that I'll never lose the capacity to get taken up, to get lost in a movie, in a good movie, especially on first viewing. Now, the, you know, the stuff that I've you know, taught and written about are films that I've looked at, you know, occupational hazard wise, again, you know, dozens, if not more than dozens of times, and there's something about a good film, obviously, that especially, as I said, on first viewing, that will capture you, and you give yourself to it, and you lose your sense of time, and you lose your distance, your kind of critical distance. And, you know, it's worth suggesting, too, that you know, the old, in terms of the way movies work, that hasn't changed very much. The kind of things that people really like about movies, the, you know, the kind of classical design of the films hasn't changed as much as the business has changed. And it's the nice thing about that old business is that it cranked out a lot of movies. And the things about movies that tend to work and to capture audiences hasn't changed all that much. So whether it's an old movie or a new movie, you know, the success of these cable channels that are, you know, recirculating these old movies is a real good indication that there's still something about them that appeals to viewers, that we do, that our sense of time is suspended in it when we're watching a good movie.